You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new cookbook uses ingredients you'd find in a typical food pantry. We'll find out how it's helping people who are dealing with food insecurity here in Wisconsin. Now, when we think of wildfires, we might think of the western part of the U.S., but we've experienced some substantial fires here in Wisconsin in the distant past and in more recent years. Spring is the time wildfires are most likely to happen in the state when snow has melted, humidity is low, and people burn yard waste. Earlier this month, the state DNR listed 52 counties as very high risk for wildfires. That's gone down a lot since then. Our next guest has advice on preventing wildfires in the spring and throughout the year. Catherine Cooley is a wildfire prevention specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Catherine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. Always great to be here.
Can you talk a little more about why spring is seen sometimes as peak wildfire season in the state?
You know, that's such a great question to start with, because I think there are a lot of misconceptions out there. Spring is certainly wildfire season in Wisconsin. You know, shortly after that snow cover disappears and right before vegetation fully greens out, that is really the peak of our fire season. You know, a lot of times we see the Western fire situation, you know, really heating up over the summer. But ours is before that summertime occurs. So certainly we're on the downslope of our peak. But certainly, you know, there are opportunities for more fires to occur.
Yeah. Earlier this month, wow, 52 counties at very high risk. Happily, that's come down since then. Does that time of year get to be a nail biter for you?
Absolutely. It's been a busy couple weeks here. And certainly this year was more of a traditional fire season in the sense where, you know, kind of started in the southern part of the state and moved north as that snow cover disappeared. But we've been steady, you know, since mid-March. And, you know, usually fire season, you know, the bulk of that fire activity wraps up by Labor Day. So we're on track for a very average fire year.
What are some of the most common causes of a wildfire here in the state?
So believe it or not, 98% of our fires are caused by people. And, you know, the good news is 98% of them can be prevented. You know, the biggest thing we see is folks getting out, you know, living with that snow and wanting to get out and clean up around your yard. And then folks choosing to burn that stuff. So, you know, leaves, brush, pine needles, and then deciding to light that stuff up and have a fire. And a lot of times, you know, people don't know the rules, they don't know the fire danger, or they walk away from their fire. And a lot of times that's what causes the damage.
If people are going to burn that yard waste like that, what are the rules? What do they need to know before they do it?
So I kind of like to think of it in terms of like a three-step process. So think of, you know, before you decide to burn, you know, during your burn and then after your burn. So before you decide you want to burn your pile, you know, consider alternatives. You know, there are other options out there. You don't have to burn that pile. Know what the burning permits are. Follow the rules on that permit. You know, a lot of times people just get the permit and think, oh, I'm okay. In reality, there's a lot of great tips on there. There's certain times we encourage people to burn, typically in the evening when the conditions are a little bit safer. And then, you know, make sure that what you're burning is legal, and then keep an eye on that weather, and then make sure that the area around your fire is free from any flammable material. And then while you're burning, make sure you have a water source, you have some tools. You know, you're not making your fire too big. Make it manageable, something that you can, you know, control under your supervision. Clear that area around that fire break, make sure nothing's creeping out. Never leave that fire unattended. You know, like I said, a lot of times people will light it, they'll be burning for a couple hours, and then they'll just walk away. And a lot of times those fires will kick up some embers in there and then start a fire as well. And then after you burn, you know, you got to make sure it's out. Those little embers can hide in there for days, even weeks, believe it or not. So making sure that those coals are completely cold, lots of water, stir, and then go back and check it again later.
It's a camping season in Wisconsin. I'm pretty sure most campers in Wisconsin know the rules for their campfires. But for maybe first timers, can you let them know what to make sure they're doing?
Absolutely. And you know what? It's kind of the same rule of thumb. So think of it in terms of that three-step process, before, during, and after. I mean, we've got the Memorial Day weekend this weekend. We're going to have, you know, cooler nights still. So a lot of campfires on the horizon. And, you know, just, you know, if you can, try to kind of have it in the evening, you know, make sure you're around it, keeping it attended, like I said, you know, and then also just, making sure that the fires are, under your control the entire time. So a lot of times people will maybe have a couple cocktails and then go for a walk or go do something else. A lot of times we see things happen under those circumstances, unfortunately.
Wisconsin has a big fire history, the Peshtigo Fire that happened the same night as the Great Chicago Fire. It was huge and destructive. But we don't have to go back that far. There was that big German Road Fire in Douglas and Bayfield counties in 2013. That's the kind of thing we're worried about here, right?
Absolutely. I think while wildfire events are far fewer in numbers in terms of the window of opportunity for these large scale events, Wisconsin is not safe from a catastrophic fire. These things can happen under the right conditions. In 2013, when the German Road Fire did happen that burned 8,000 acres, that was one of our lower fire years in terms of fire occurrence. It sprinkled that morning. Folks thought, things are, not so bad. Unfortunately, a spark in the wrong place at the right time can really result in those events.
What kind of resources are there for people to find out the current fire risk in their local area?
So the DNR does a great job of monitoring the weather conditions, the fuel moistures. You can go to the DNR homepage and search fire, dnr.wi.gov, and we monitor that fire danger every day. We look at those reports in the morning right away and have that fire danger updated every day at 11 a.m. That fire danger can change every day, and we can go from low to high very quickly or high to low very quickly, especially this time of year. So it's really important to not become complacent and think you know what the fire danger was yesterday, because it could be a different story today.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Catherine Cooley, wildfire prevention specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She talked to us about wildfire prevention here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about pregnancy during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Tens of thousands of people in the U.S. turn to fertility clinics every year to help them grow their families. For many of those hopeful parents, the process can be an emotional roller coaster, not to mention expensive. Alexandra Meyer of Milwaukee is one mother who tried in vitro fertilization and other methods when she was trying to get pregnant. And then the pandemic hit. Meyer shares her experience as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
I had fertility treatments lined up to start at the end of March 2020. Then COVID hit, and the stay-at-home order came down. When I called the clinic a few days later, the nurse said, "I'm really sorry. We aren't doing any procedures. We're not seeing any patients." Fertility treatment has been deemed non-essential. So then, because this is something that for me was essential in order to have my child, having treatments put on pause and not knowing when the end date of that pause would be was super scary. And then I call in April. "Sorry, we can't do it this month." May. "We're really sorry. We can't do it this month either." In June, finally they say, "We can get you in." The first procedure we did was an IUI. And then 2 weeks later, I got another negative pregnancy test, like I'd seen so many times before. After 3 unsuccessful rounds of IUI, we decided to transition to IVF. My doctor told me, "If you get COVID during any point of your treatment plan, we have to stop. You're out all of that money. You have to pay for it again to do it again, and you have lost that chance." COVID cases in Wisconsin were surging, and I didn't know if a simple interaction would get me sick or not. We had been dealing with infertility for 6 years at that point, and I couldn't lose this chance because I was finally feeling hopeful. The supply chain issues we had throughout the pandemic didn't just affect toilet paper. It also affected IVF meds. And when I went to the pharmacy to pick up these extremely expensive medications, they told me, "We don't know if we have them all in stock. And if I don't have these medications, then we might have to cancel the cycle." Luckily, they had it. They were able to do an egg retrieval after a lot of at-home injections. The egg retrieval gave us 3 viable embryos. After my embryo transfer, I tested early at home. It was so early in the morning. I looked at it and like, here it is again, another negative. So I leave it on the counter. I'm crying. I go back to bed. I'm done. This was a positive pregnancy test, and I'd gotten so used to negative tests that I just thought it would be negative, and I was too tired to look at it closely. I tested every day leading up to our blood draw, and the line kept getting darker. Like, it's happening. It's really happening this time. I just really hope that for those that do IVF during the pandemic, that they get their miracle babies too.
Alexandra Meyer of Milwaukee welcomed a baby girl in July 2021. They enjoy snuggling and reading books together. Meyer's story comes to us from the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the resiliency, humor, and heartbreak of pregnancy and birth during the COVID-19 pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new cookbook aims to help low-income families in Wisconsin make ends meet. We'll hear from a creator with some advice on cooking on a budget. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, a woman from Grafton developed a cookbook that uses ingredients you'd typically find at a food pantry. She's hoping the cookbook will help make cooking more accessible for food pantry clients. The book was created for Family Sharing, a nonprofit food pantry serving Ozaukee County. Connie Roller is the author of the cookbook. Connie, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And Julie Hoover is executive director of Family Sharing. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Now, Connie, I understand you'd already written a couple cookbooks for family and friends. Where did the inspiration for this food pantry cookbook come from?
Well, it's a two-part thing. Number one, I had my teenage daughter had a friend whose mother just cooked opening cans, and he came here to eat all the time. And when I produced one of my family cookbooks, gave him a copy, he went to the grocery store carrying that copy every single time he went. And he learned to cook from that, and he definitely has a better life. The other was just, you know, seeing the products that people donated to Family Sharing, and I would look around at all of those things, and my mind just jumped to, wow, what could I do with all this? And the idea just kind of snowballed from there.
And Julie, can you talk about the work you do at the food pantry and why this kind of cookbook could be helpful with education on nutrition and cooking?
Absolutely. So we serve people across Ozaukee County, and the organization has been around since the 70s. We have a mobile pantry that goes out in the community and a number of other programs to serve. And I remember when I first started here, I met a gentleman who grew up, his mother refused to make pancakes. They never had pancakes in the house. And it turns out that she grew up going to a food pantry, and that was the thing that they had all the time. It was their only option. And that was such an aha to me, because growing up in my house, pancakes were a treat. And I thought, there's so many things that we give out to people every single time they come to the food pantry that we really have to think about providing something that's new and different. Nobody wants to eat the exact same thing over and over again. So it's something that had been on my mind for years. And when Connie approached me wanting to do a cookbook, I thought, oh, this is such a great opportunity to take the things that we give away to our regular clients, but put a spin on them to keep them interesting, to make sure that their kids eat them and they get utilized. So we were thrilled that Connie had the skills and the heart to want to do this.
Connie, can you talk about how you tried to, you know, mix things up and have variety in the foods that people might see regularly at their pantry?
Well, I started out with, Julie provided me a list of the common food pantry ingredients that people donated. And then I reached out to a lot of friends and family who are also foodies like me. And said, okay, this is the list we have. Let's come up with some recipes that could utilize these ingredients and elevate them. You know, you cannot just keep opening a can of soup. You can't just keep making a boxed scalloped potatoes. You have to be able to do more and more. And I guess that's how it started.
Julie, can you talk about food insecurity in Ozaukee County? I know I've talked to your counterparts in some of your neighboring counties who say, you know, even our local community might not be aware of the need for this.
Absolutely. There's definitely a need. We have a lot of people who live above the poverty line. We don't have as much homelessness as maybe some other counties have, but a lot of people who don't make enough to live in this county. As many people know, Ozaukee County is one of the wealthier counties, but that means that everything is more expensive here. Rent, getting your car fixed, childcare are all more expensive. So for people to keep up, even before the inflation that we've started to see, it's a struggle for a lot of people. And sometimes they have to make choices between buying food and buying medication or childcare and food. So we're here to help provide the food so that their precious resources can go to the other essential items in their budget.
Connie, can you talk about how you dealt with substitutions? Maybe, frozen corn might be available one week, canned corn another. How do you, in your recipes, let people know, hey, you could substitute this stuff?
In the foreword of my cookbook, I actually address that issue that you may not always have the exact ingredients that are available to you. For instance, canned beans in a soup or a casserole. If you don't have kidney beans, use black beans. If you don't have, if you don't have frozen peas, use canned peas or fresh peas or whatever. Food pantries have come a long way lately in having a lot more fresh ingredients as opposed to just canned. So there's a lot more options out there. But substituting or improvising, I encourage it because that's how I cook. I don't follow recipes. I just cook with what I have and God bless it, it turns out.
I got to ask, Connie, because that's kind of how I tend to cook. And I've definitely had my Polish grandma just cooked, you put in the right amount of stuff. There's no writing down. Was it a challenge for you to take those recipes, those ideas in your head and like put them in a form that the rest of us can reproduce?
No, actually, that's not a challenge for me. That's very, very easy for me to do. I have a background in writing, editing. I've done 2 family cookbooks already, so that's easy for me.
And
that's part of, why I wanted to do this for family sharing is because I could do this easily. I could go there and I could volunteer and I could sort donations, or I could use the talents that I have to make something a little bit better. Right now, the only thing I need to do to make this a little bit better is to raise the funds to actually get these cookbooks printed and handed out.
And Julie, what are your hopes for getting the cookbooks more available to more people?
Well, first, I have to say to Connie, that is quite the skill. That is not a skill I have.
Right.
So I'm in awe of that. So, you know, it enables us to do what we do best, that we can get it in the hands of our clients and have the conversation with them of what it is and how it came to fruition and how they can utilize it. So we're excited to get it in their hands and get them excited about cooking. They're busy with families, with a job, two jobs, daycare, everything else that goes with it. So the fact that these are delicious and easy, we're excited to give them to people and maybe even make some samples of certain recipes so that people can try it and then entice them to expand their cooking horizons. I think we all get in ruts sometimes. So,
and Connie, as you just said, you were inspired to use your talents to help people. If there's other people out there with talents, whether it's cooking or something else, can you leave us with a little encouragement for them to use those talents to help people out?
You know, I guess I have to say, whatever your talents are, if you have a talent for photography, go to an animal shelter and take beautiful photos of pets that need homes. If you have a talent for cooking, maybe offer cooking lessons to somebody. If you have a talent for making money, donate to me being able to print this cookbook and get it out to as many people as possible.
Fantastic. Connie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
That was Connie.
We appreciate it.
It's Connie Roller, author of the cookbook From Pantry to Table, and Julie Hoover, executive director of Family Sharing, with us today to talk about Connie's new cookbook, which she wrote specifically for ingredients that people find typically at a food pantry. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. crossed the 1 million mark for COVID deaths, with millions more affected by those losses. A Wisconsin philosopher joins the show to tell us why it can be hard to wrap our minds around those numbers. Plus, an author tells us why some of the weird things of the English language, how they ended up that way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the U.S. is still struggling with addiction problems, and rural Wisconsin is no exception. Find out how clinics in the state are trying to help people deal with addiction and connect people with the resources they need. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state Republican Party held its annual convention over the weekend. We'll learn more on the biggest stories for the GOP in this year's midterm races. First, the nationwide addiction problem continues, with over 100,000 overdose deaths last year in the U.S., according to numbers out this month from the CDC. And many rural communities are struggling with the problem, in part because of a lack of treatment resources. A new program started this spring to train medical providers in rural Wisconsin on how to treat and prevent substance abuse. The program, called the Wisconsin Rural Health and Substance Abuse Clinical Support, is a statewide effort with the Wisconsin Hospital Association and the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. The clinical support program was started after a $1 million community action grant from the Wisconsin Partnership Program. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? Have you or someone you know experienced issues with access to treatment for addiction? Is it hard to find? Have you or a loved one had to travel a long way to get treatment if you were able to find it in the first place? And if you work in healthcare in a rural part of the state, what are you seeing in your clinic, your hospital? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Randall Brown is a family physician specializing in the treatment and prevention of substance abuse disorders. He's the director of the Center for Addictive Disorders at UW Health and a professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Brown, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the unique challenges that rural parts of the state face when it comes to diagnosing and then treating addictions?
Well, when we think about treatment, I think most folks think about your specialist treatment centers, say intensive outpatient or places to go for residential treatment. But those aren't universally or necessarily immediately available, particularly in our rural communities. And the fact of the matter is not everyone necessarily needs that level of care. And there's good research to tell us that with appropriate resources and backup, that a number of these issues can be assessed and managed fairly successfully in sites that rural residents may have better access to, including primary care, peer recovery services, and when issues are urgent, that hospitals can participate in that process as well.
How big a problem is addiction in Wisconsin, and rural Wisconsin in particular?
Well, it's really been on a concerning trend over the last two decades on a few particular fronts. Alcohol has been continuing on the rise and appears to have been exacerbated, particularly during the course of the pandemic. Opioids have continued to be a particular problem in the Midwest and in Wisconsin in particular, where over the last 3 years, nationally, the average increase in opioid overdoses was around 30%, where in our area it was closer to 70%. And we're also seeing a lot more concerning patterns around methamphetamine use in the state as well, with law enforcement reports involving methamphetamine increasing over four times over the last 5 years. So a lot of things going on, and it's incumbent on a number of sort of parts of the system, be it healthcare or social services or communities, that really need to be working together if we're going to start to get ahead of it.
Talking to Dr. Randall Brown from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at addiction in rural Wisconsin and a new effort to help clinicians around the state, doctors, family doctors in particular, help treat their patients and connect them with treatment they need. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see in your community when it comes to addiction and access or lack of access to treatment? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Brown, let's check out this partnership now. What kind of things are you doing to work with local healthcare providers?
So I feel really fortunate to be working with the Wisconsin Hospital Association and also Wisconsin Voices for Recovery on the effort. So the Wisconsin Hospital Association it's a network of 155 hospitals and associated clinics statewide. So we'll be able to leverage that reach in order to get contact with critical access hospitals and providers in those facilities and clinics to get them some educational resources and some expert support during the course of their clinic day that they can call into and get advice around patient management when it comes to substance-related issues. We're going to be running some virtual office hours as well for folks to come in and discuss patient management issues or just system issues, like how they get efforts like this off the ground, how do they effectively implement these forms of screening, assessment, prevention, and treatment in the settings where they're working and seeing these folks. An additional important aspect of the effort is going to be expansion of peer recovery support services. Listeners may have heard of peer recovery coaches, and Wisconsin Voices for Recovery is going to be our partner there, working to expand availability of that resource. And these are individuals with lived experience who can connect with someone, say, commonly at a point of care in the emergency department where they've reported with a substance-related issue. And these are individuals that can provide some ongoing support, assist them with connection to services, and do what they can to help folks with desired positive behavior change to keep them healthy.
I wanted to ask you more about those peer recovery specialists. Now, these are people, as you said, who have lived experience likely with an addiction themselves. What kind of training do they get then to help others who are, as you say, maybe showing up in an emergency room?
So that is a set of trainings that varies quite a bit you know, from state to state, but there is a particular program of training provided through Safer Communities here. And I have to say, I don't have sort of number of hours off the top of my head, but it is a formal process resulting in a credential that would allow them to bill for these services so that it can be a sustainable resource for people in these communities.
With this program, I want to take this into some different points of entry for someone dealing with addiction and how they might come into contact with. Let's stay in the emergency room now. Working with the hospital association, what kind of, I guess, education or resources are you making available, say, to a rural hospital emergency room to say, okay, we're treating this person maybe for a fentanyl overdose. Say, how do we not just treat that? How do we get them in touch with other resources out there?
Well, one of the things that we know that can be particularly effective is getting medication started for the opioid use disorder or opioid addiction at that point of care in the emergency department that can then be continued in the community. And there's a lot of research to back that up, but unfortunately, it's not yet a practice that's super widely implemented due to a variety of barriers, one of which being volume of providers in the community that have had the training and that have the comfort level to continue that treatment. And so that's going to be another sort of aspect of these efforts is getting that training out there so that more providers are familiar with initiating and continuing that treatment for patients. And again, sort of providing these, expert resources that they can reach out to as challenges arise in the course of the practice. So that'd be a primary example. Another would be issues around alcohol, say individuals coming in with alcohol withdrawal, where we will be providing education around evidence-based withdrawal management and ongoing management. There are also medications that can be helpful in reducing the desire to consume at previous levels that have been leading to various forms of dysfunction or impact. Those would be some of the examples where we're hoping to build that comfort level and that confidence in the workforce to start addressing those issues. And through this network, also develop those connections between emergency departments, hospitals, and clinics where patients would be following up after a presentation for an urgent issue.
We're talking to Dr. Randall Brown, family physician specializing in substance use disorder treatments and prevention, talking with us about a new program in Wisconsin working to improve healthcare and treatment for people in rural areas who are struggling with various kinds of substance abuse. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your story? Have you or someone in your family had trouble with addiction? Were you able to find treatment? Was it close by? Do you have a success story to share, maybe? Or are you still trying to find the help that you or your family member or friend needs? If you work in healthcare, especially in a rural part of the state, what do you wish you had available to you? What questions do you have for our guest about what's going on about this partnership here? Have you been a peer counselor yourself? We were just talking about you. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Randall Brown, family physician specializing in the treatment and prevention of substance use disorders. He's talking to us now about a new statewide program called Wisconsin Rural Health and Substance Use Clinical Support. You could join in at 800-642-1234. I know it's not always easy to talk about, but if you are willing to share your story of you or someone in your family dealing with addiction, seeking treatment, if so, were you able to find it? Are you still looking? A little bit of both. You got some help, but not all that you need. If you provide health care, especially in rural Wisconsin or elsewhere, what kind of support would help you? And what kind of things are you seeing and hearing from your patients? If you're a doctor, a clinician, a nurse practitioner, emergency room worker, or a first responder, let us know what you're seeing in your community. Join in now. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Brown, we were just in the emergency room. Now, for that, say, family care clinic, what kind of help can you offer them to maybe spot the warning signs of addiction and help their patients get the help they need?
So a good deal of that, it depends to some extent on substance. To start with, alcohol being by far the most common in our area, there are recommendations on the part of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force for us in primary care to be doing universal screening for risky alcohol use or an alcohol use disorder. And this is one of the top 10 most cost-effective practices in which we can engage in primary care, but sometimes tricky to get implemented and effectively put in place in terms of workflows. But very important because it isn't just use disorder in that setting, but risky use. A lot of the harm related to alcohol, as folks would likely know, is related to, say, binge drinking episodes and accidental injury, motor vehicle accidents. And so that screening and brief counseling to help prevent those sorts of instances is a real important part of practice in primary care as well as in hospital settings. With other drugs, they're actually universally isn't necessarily a recommendation for universal screening, but there would certainly be populations at greater risk where there is that recommendation. So, or recommendation based on sort of the level of risk presented by substance use. So during pregnancy would be an example where universal screening for other substances is recommended. And for individuals that have had a history of, say, adverse childhood experiences or abuse, the risk for future substance use problems is quite high, and so important to have that on radar under those sets of conditions as well. And during adolescence, in the course of regular exams, simply checking in around radical changes sort of in behavior or social interaction, peer group, academic performance, can be some red flags that substance use may be coming up and is worth doing some exploration and seeing if intervention is desired and warranted.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Sauk Prairie. Sarah, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I have a personal experience. I am an alcoholic. I've been sober for 9 months now, but I've had some experiences where I've needed to get help with withdrawals. And at the emergency hospital here, I've just been sent home.
And not connected with other resources, Sarah?
No. No.
What do you wish, if you're willing to share, what would you hope for when you show up at the emergency room with withdrawal? What would you hope they could connect you with?
Yeah, so, well, for one thing, getting through the withdrawal safely. And then some treatment options and things like that. I've been taken just to the county detox center. But that's the only option here in this area, and that's in Madison. And I was taken there in handcuffs and shackles because of having to be transported by a police officer.
Sarah, thanks so much for sharing your story. Congratulations on the 9 months. And that Sarah, Dr. Brown, Sarah is hoping for some of the things you are hoping to provide, it sounds like.
Yeah, boy, and I'm really sorry to hear that you've had that experience, and it's all too common, you know, when we're talking about, you know, getting folks to the care they need after those acute situations, some of which, again, you know, can be a function of the amount of resource that's available in the area and the wait that people may need to go through in order to access that. And so hopefully, you know, as time passes and providers get a little more familiar with this, you know, at least some resources in primary care settings can be brought to bear that can assist with some early change and some ongoing care perhaps connection to peer recovery that can provide those initial services until a higher level of care comes available if it's needed. But yeah, it is a gap that we see far too often, and has been much more common in the context of the pandemic as well. We know that treatment admissions during the early course of the pandemic had dropped 75%. And that isn't because these issues were going away. It was, of course, because of related precautions. And that's, led to some pretty serious concerns, particularly, again, in our rural areas where those resources are even hard to come by, when a pandemic isn't part of the equation.
Thanks again, Sarah, for being willing to share that with us. We're talking to Dr. Randall Brown with UW Health and the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at addiction, access to treatment in Wisconsin, and a program he's working on, especially working in rural parts of the state with hospitals and local doctors, trying to connect people with resources they need to deal with addiction treatment. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tom joins us now in New Franken. Tom, hi.
Yeah, I was wondering, you've got all these programs to help the addict. How about the family that's involved with this? Because if it's just the addict who gets better, I've seen where the family still ends up messed up, and actually families break apart because the addict straightens out their act and the rest of the family doesn't know how to deal with it.
Tom, thanks for that call. I'll point you, Tom, toward the morning show. It was a couple few weeks back. There was a whole hour conversation about people in families with a person who's addicted. Do dig through the morning show archives and find that. Dr. Brown, are there ways, especially in your program, to help families connect with this support?
Boy, that's a really great question and a great point, because for those living with someone struggling with a substance use disorder, addressing the needs of the family is important. A number of programs do have that integrated into planning by way of family therapy. And if it isn't well integrated, we certainly encourage family members to be seeking out therapy for themselves. Participation in peer recovery groups is also out there, in programs such as, for example, Al-Anon, to get folks that have family members struggling some of the support they need to navigate the recovery process and the impact that the use has had on them.
Tom, thanks for the call. And we're going to get that link to the morning show program I mentioned up at WPR.org/Central Time. So you can find that there. Dr. Brown, if there are healthcare providers out there listening saying, yeah, I want to work with you, how do they get in touch? How can they be part of this program?
So the website for Department of Family Medicine, so the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they can search up our Project Echo and our consultation provider hotline. And that provides some information on those particular educational resources, as well as what we call our boot camp series. They're 1 to 2 day conferences where we really take a deep dive into a lot of this subject matter, do a lot of case-based learning, so that folks can be sort of thinking about those clinical circumstances. So that website is www.fammed.wisc.edu. And there's a search bar there. And if they look into things, around addiction medicine or those particular programs, those will pop up.
All right, and we'll get that posted at WPR.org/Central Time as well. Very briefly, Dr. Brown, you're just getting this up and running. Do you have a next step in mind once you've got this out in the public?
Well, yeah, we're hoping that this will have a fair reach statewide, and that as it moves forward, we'll be continuing to get feedback from those participating. And then who knows, maybe this becomes something that could be of use in other states and localities to get treatment services more widely available in rural areas, particularly.
Dr. Brown, thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's Dr. Randall Brown, director of the Center for Addictive Disorders at UW Health, family physician specializing in the treatment and prevention of substance use disorders, also professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us today to talk about the Wisconsin Rural Health and Substance Use Clinical Support Program, a statewide effort to improve care for patients who are struggling with substance abuse in rural Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.